Irish, was it Irish priest? There are some of you here today who will burn. Yeah, anyway. Nor am I going to do an exegesis on that passage. It's just the passage that came to me while I was pondering. Yeah, because it seems to me that my learning about Christ is that Christ came in grace, and yet so many of us through millennia have been held by that called Christianity in a state of shame or fear of shame. Yeah. I don't think shame per se, before I get into it, don't think shame per se is necessarily always a bad thing. I was listening to the All in the Mind program on the ABC a few weeks ago, and there was a psychologist talking about how shame is a useful corrective thing to have within us. You know, it stops us from maybe next Christmas party at work, we don't tell the boss what we think of him after we've had one too many drinks, you know, because we've experienced shame. Or, you know, in our caveman past, we don't want to be the person whose behaviour was responsible for putting the rest of the tribe in a state of danger. So maybe shame is, in, you know, part of our makeup. So that's not the shame I'm going to be talking about. The shame I'm going to be talking about is that which prevents us from experiencing and from being the conveyors of the grace that we receive from God. And I'm not going to do much talking. Well, from my own stuff, I'm going to say a little bit, but I'd like to just read you a story, to be honest. So I hope you're going to be sitting comfortably. I'll read you a story. First, let's pray together. Father, Mother, God, thank you that you hear us, not as some remote alien force beyond reach, but the intimate, indwelling, loving God at the core of who we are. From the centre, you hear us. Thank you for the community you've formed with us and within us. Thank you for the outrageous assurance of your reckless, extravagant love for us. May we learn to trust the word of Christ and know the communion with you, which is found in communion with one another. May we look upon one another with grace-healed eyes. May we know one another as your beloved. May we resist the fear, our urge to hide. Trust our common shared brokenness as the strongest foundation for community. May we hold a mirror for one another, shining light on shadowed beauty. Emboldened, may we risk ourselves to be known. With courage, may we abandon ourselves to your promise. Amen. I was talking to Claire recently, and part of the shame was that I had a great inspiration for speaking at church a few months ago while I was walking, and I completely forgot all about it. And last week I rang up Claire and said, I haven't got anything, and I'm ashamed of that. And we talked a bit about how, well, what has Easter done to change the world? And I thought about that theme, what has Easter done to change the world? And it made me wonder, what did Easter do to change the world of the people in the time of Jesus' crucifixion? What's the same and what's different? And it seemed to me that if Jesus Christ came to take the pain and suffering away from this world, that he failed comprehensively. Easter did not remove the mess. However, the life of Christ can change the way that we look at the world, the way we experience the mess. And I'd say one of the key changes in perception inspired by Christ is our relationship to shame, and therefore a change in the way we relate to our world, to one another, and to ourselves. The life of Jesus confronts any notion I may have that God is to be characterized as seemly, well-ordered, polite, non-confrontational, in the eyes of the world, that is. Jesus came into the world in a shameful way. For all intents and purposes, Jesus entered the world the illegitimate son of an unwed woman. An ignominious start. In the eyes of the world, Jesus started his time of ministry by opening the scroll of Isaiah and committing a shameful act in that synagogue. People started wanting to kill him from that day onwards. His teaching brought scandal, turned people upside down. And his death on a cross was the most profoundly shaming way to die there is. It interests me that most depictions have strategically placed pieces of loincloth, but that's not what crucifixion was. Do people remember the photographs taken in Abu Ghraib jail in Iraq? The women standing on the naked prisoners? Shame. Jesus' death wasn't just about torturing him slowly to death. It was about shaming him. His genitals exposed, his body spread-eagled. And the amazing thing for me is that it would seem that God embraces all this shame. So if we're to learn anything about the nature of God by observing the life of Jesus Christ, it's that God expresses God's self in a way that we might find hard to choose. And that God doesn't intervene in our history in spite of these things, in spite of this shame, but precisely through it. It struck me that when we've had series of sermons way, way back in my distant past about when we're going to be elect elders, and there were sermons about what to look for in an elder, it struck me that Jesus wouldn't have made the cut to be an elder in our church. He just wasn't well enough regarded. I remember when I was a little kid, my family, my dad being a minister, we used to be invited to things, official days and stuff, and we went to Sister Kate's. Has everyone heard of Sister Kate's in Mosman Park above the ocean there? And there was a mural on one of the rooms, the dormitories, cleanliness is next to godliness. And I remember my dad saying to the woman showing us around, you know, that's not biblical. And she said, oh, sorry, Reverend Maley. And he was just saying, well, it's... And I remember as a kid looking up and thinking, yeah, why did he have to say that, Dad? Like, he actually seemed quite peeved by it, that they had it up. And he was kind of muttering to himself. And it seems to me, if I'm interpreting him correctly from all these years later, that cleanliness next to godliness doesn't reflect the fact that godliness is in the midst of the mess. And mess often equals shame in our eyes. And if God embraces the mess, then God must be embracing the shame. Mess equals being out of control. And maybe being out of control is the first necessary step. Because only when we've given up the notion of being self-sufficient can we become dependent on God. When we accept that the Lord is our shepherd, we're the sheep. Doesn't go well with, you know, the trend for self-efficacy, does it? We are the sheep. At Easter time, Bevan shared with us his image of the new tree emerging from the burnt-out stump. For me, a great image for resurrection. And it makes me think, what if the new tree emerges not in spite of the ravage of fire, but simply because that is God's perfect way of creating a tree? What if Jesus' life, death, resurrection were victorious, not in spite of shame, but within God's embrace of it, and that entering into human shame is simply God's way of transforming it and allowing us to see it in a different way? What is my blackened remnant? What is our blackened remnant? Maybe it's different for all of us. But what is the thing that we are ashamed of through which God might be wanting to transform us? What in us has been ravaged, damaged, injured? What are we tempted to hide about? Might it be the very thing that causes me to feel shame is the foothold for God's grace? I have a friend who's a single mum, and she goes to church, and she was talking to me about how when she's in church, she has to pretend that everything's fine, and that she experiences grace outside the church with people who accept the messiness of life. But because she's been brought up in a certain way in a church, she has to pretend. It seems to me that the necessity to pretend is something that probably has happened to many of us. Has anyone else ever had to pretend, felt they had to pretend in church? I went to Fairbridge and there was a gospel choir there. And please, I'm not having a go at them, okay, what I'm going to say next. However, for me and the way I was processing how I experienced that choir was that there was one valid way to express being in Christ, and that was to be a shiny, happy person. Now, I'm not, maybe just a grumpy old man. I get that. But that sense of creating a bubble of shiny happiness, pointing to the ceiling, felt like I didn't have an option to get close to that person. That there was only one valid expression of being in Christ, and that was to be a shiny, happy person. I remember a story about the man in London. The standard part of your uniform is a tightly rolled umbrella. And the guy that would tap his barometer every morning, and if the barometer didn't dip and thought it won't be raining, he'll take his very, very tightly wound. It's very important if you work in the city, a very tightly wound umbrella. And if it was going to rain, he'd take his old tatty one so that he would look smart when he took his umbrella, and they use it as a walking stick. And then one day, of course, the barometer didn't work and he had his really good quality tightly wound umbrella that he'd never unwound. And it started raining and he opened it up and it's full of holes. Is that the shiny exterior belied something inside that wasn't the same. Maybe that reflects back to that passage that we heard. Remember being part of a prayer group, and the purpose was to pray for things in our community. And it worried me that it seemed to be a way of us assembling an agenda for God to follow, rather than to simply surrender and imagine ourselves as part of God's agenda. It seems to me that the shame that comes in when we don't become part of that which would set God's agenda, that's how I experienced it. So, fearing shame, we may never allow ourselves to surrender, and in not surrendering, we may never get to experience the grace of God. First step of the AA movement of the 12 steps is to say, I'm helpless. That's why many people that I met who are part of that fellowship share richly with me, because they've been through the stage of saying, I'm helpless. Anyway, I have a deep feeling that God enters our world as a living Christ, embracing shame in order that we might change the way we experience life. That Jesus is singularly disinterested in whether people assess him as good, according to social mores, and he's similarly disposed in his assessment of us. I experience Christ as being passionately interested in us being whole and true, that he'd have us come out of our shame-based hiding, not in order to judge us, because he wants to know what we're having for dinner, because he wants to come to our place. So while we stay in the shame story, God continues to be the God who's chasing us away from Eden, and we are the frightened fugitives. But what if that footsteps behind us? What if that is God pursuing us tirelessly, steadfastly, chasing us, hoping that we might just stop running? turn around and receive the love that God loves to pour upon us. Here's a little story. It's written by a hospice chaplain. It's called Gloria's Baby. It's in an American context, so you'll endure that. Gloria picked up a strawberry from the bowl in front of her and handed it to me. She had two over-the-bed tables, the type you'd find in a hospital, on either side of her recliner. They were covered with catalogues and magazines, get-well cards from friends who no longer came to visit, cell phone and television remote, notepad and pen, lip balm, tissues, bottles of water, books of crossword puzzles, and a crocheting project I never once saw her pick up or make any progress on. All the things she might need at any time. She would swing one table in front and over her legs and the other out of the way with a practiced hand. Today, the table in front of her had a big bowl full of strawberries and a much smaller bowl full of strawberry stems. She was gleeful about those strawberries. She ate each one in a single huge bite, emptying one bowl and filling the other with a remarkable speed. "These make me feel like I'm a little girl again on the farm, out in the sunshine," she said. "You know, I can't remember the last time I spent a day out in the sunshine." Then, "Of course, I don't miss the heat, being out in the field, you understand. Just the sunshine, I miss that feeling." "Did you grow up on a farm?" I asked. "No, no," she said quickly. "I just spent a lot of time there when I was a child." The conversation meandered somewhere else, but in a few minutes she grew quiet and pensive. She picked up another strawberry and ate it very slowly with her eyes closed. "I want to tell you a story," she said. "Every Sunday after church, we all came home and put on our work clothes. My grandmother came to pick us up in a big car. Me and my brothers and my father, we all drove out to the country, to a farm. It was a farm of a black family, not a very big farm, and kind of falling apart because there was no farmer. He was dead. It was just his wife out there trying to hold on. We'd go out there and we'd work our fingers to the bone, all of us, even my grandmother. We were out in the fields helping with harvesting and pulling weeds. Even when I was real little, I picked up stones out of the dirt so they could plough. We worked in the house and the barns fixing whatever needed fixing, cleaning whatever needed cleaning. I didn't mind, though. I actually really liked it because there are half a dozen children out there we could play with. We went down to the creek and played hide and seek. We built forts and fairy lands and played little jokes on each other. We had so much fun. Their mother would have a huge dinner waiting for us, and later there was supper too. I loved going out there, but I never knew who they were or why we went there. We never visited any other black folks, just that one family. We never went to any other farm, just that one. I asked when I was little, but was always told to hush. I asked once when I was a teenager who they were and why we went out there every single Sunday, but my mother slapped me hard across the face, told me to never ask again, so I didn't. When I grew up and got married, had my own children, I stopped going out there. I don't know if my father and grandmother continued because I never asked. It was just not something we could talk about, ever. Then I sort of forgot. Not really, but I never thought about it after a while. We never talked about that family. I never saw them again. I don't think I ever knew their last name. Years went by, and then at my grandmother's funeral, a black woman came up to me. She threw her arms around me. "Do you recognize me?" she asked. Well, I was totally confused. "No," I said. "I'm Betty," she said, "from the farm. On Sundays, we used to play together when we were little girls." And then I did recognize her. I hadn't seen her since I was a teenager, but I knew her. And then, well, my goodness. Then she said, "I'm your cousin." Kerry, I just stood there with my mouth open. That whole family, they were my cousins, my own flesh and blood. My father's brother had fallen in love with a black woman. They'd lived together in secret out in the country and had children. But then he died, leaving them alone out there, one woman and five little kids to run the farm. That's why we all went out there and worked till our fingertips bled, because she couldn't do it alone. They were my cousins, my father's nieces and nephews, my grandmother's grandchildren. Gloria sat back in a recliner and threw her hands out to the sides and laughed. All along, they were my cousins. And you had no idea all those years? Nope, it was a big secret. But Betty knew, I asked. She knew at the funeral? Had she just found out too? Oh no, she knew all her life. They all knew all along, the black children, even the little ones. They knew who we were and who they were. But wait, I think I shook my head. The children knew all along, when you came out to visit on Sundays, that you were cousins and they never told you? Why not? Because they were all sworn to secrecy, not to tell anyone until my grandmother died. Why? Because of her shame. They had to keep the secret of who they really were. Your grandmother's shame, I asked, of having black grandchildren. But she, of all of you, went out there every Sunday of her entire life until she died, even though she was so ashamed. Well, they were still the grandchildren, Gloria said, seemingly puzzled by my questions. I know they kept it a secret because they were trying to protect me. Protect you how? I asked. Kerry, she started laughing at, do you really not understand? From knowing that I had a black family, from knowing that I had an uncle had run away with a Negro woman, I reckon that's why she kept it hid, to keep me protected. But protected from what? Well, I guess from the shame. They didn't want me to have to carry the shame too, she sighed. I could tell it was time for me to be quiet. Times were just different then. We had so many secrets in my family. There are so many secrets out there in the world. I carry around some of them, secrets that have been entrusted to me by patients and family members. Most of them are personal secrets about the teller, secrets about things they did, things they thought or felt or wished, things they think they could never tell, things that happened to them, things done to them when they were small or helpless or desperate, secrets about the self. But some of the secrets I've been privy to were elaborate family-held secrets, secrets with multiple participants and levels of understanding, secrets held across generations that demanded that children be complicit in their own shame, like Gloria's cousins. Because that's what secrets are about, shame. Shame, along with a belief that keeping a secret will protect you or someone else, comes from the idea that there is some part of it, some part of us, so monstrous, so terrible, so inhuman, that it must not be known. The intense humiliation and pain of being shamed for perceived transgression just reinforces the need to keep the secret. Shamed-filled secrets are told, when they're told at all, with bodies trembling and voices shaking so hard they're barely comprehensible, with fear, urgency in equal measure, throbbing with enormous energy it's taken to keep them secret for so long. Why, after so many years, do people tell me their secrets? I don't think it's for forgiveness. I'm not a priest, rabbi, or pastor. I can't offer any sort of sacramental absolution or formal forgiveness on behalf of God. No, when someone shares a shameful secret with me, it doesn't feel like confession. It feels like unburdening. The great mid-century cultural anthropologist Ruth Benedict wrote about the differences between cultures based on shame and those based on guilt. Guilt and shame aren't the same thing. In fact, they're opposites. In a guilt-based culture, society enforces its norms and rules by instilling an internal moral compass in people that tells them when they do something wrong. When they violate it, they feel bad about what they've done and how it affects others. The guilt is over the wrongdoing. It's internally generated. Even if no one else ever knew about the transgression, it can spark guilt. In a shame-based culture, on the other hand, social control comes from a sense of honour and duty. A sense of wrongdoing comes from the fear of being shamed and ostracised by other people. Break a social norm and your honour is damaged. You are indelibly damaged, and the honour of your family as well. Shame comes from other people knowing. Shame's based on pain and fear. It works on a person being shamed, experiences emotional and psychic pain, and as a result, fears ever being shamed again. Sometimes a person is cast out of a community, physically harmed, or even killed for doing something seen as shameful, hence the desire to keep shameful things secret. While culture may rely more heavily on either shame or guilt for social control, they're not mutually exclusive. People can feel both. Shame plays as great a role in people's spiritual lives as guilt does, because it poses the existential problem. When people feel shame, they believe there's something intrinsically wrong with their very person, with their soul. Shame comes from who you believe you are, not just what you've done or felt. I was deeply ashamed of having been psychotic. I thought the very core of me was obliterated or utterly ruined at best. That shame came from the enormous stigma around mental illness in our society. It might be acceptable to introduce the topic of postpartum depression into discussions with a group of other mothers, but bringing up postpartum psychosis was a sure path to becoming a pariah. As sympathetic and beloved psychiatrist once said to me, we don't have support groups for people with drug-induced psychotic disorder caused by anesthesia during childbirth. While good friends tried to reassure me I was just wasn't myself when I was psychotic, who exactly was I? I had one answer for that. I was a bad mother. That the birth had gone so spectacularly badly didn't seem to me to indicate medical complications and poor decisions on an anesthesiologist's part. It seemed to mean that I was, at my very core, a failure as a mother. I mean, really, whose first attempt at birth goes like that? I felt like I was cursed. The corollary to all that shame, secrets. I learned the hard way not to tell people what happened to me. But the problem with secrets is that they're exhausting. And they might protect what people see as the most vulnerable places. The protection comes at enormous cost. "I have another story to tell you," Gloria said several weeks later. She'd steadily gone sicker and weaker, so that now we were visiting for the first time in a bedroom instead of a living room. Despite her exhaustion, Joe, she'd insisted on getting up and dressed and in a chair. We'd been having a good time talking about the indignity of having to accept help from her neighbour, Ronald, with bathing and the bathroom. Many southern women of her age might have been embarrassed, but Gloria found it hilarious that the last man who would probably see her naked was an unemployed 40-year-old gay man. "So it's come to this," she laughed. Then she stopped laughing and bit her lips. "And that's, it's not just a story I want to tell you. You have to do something for me." "I'll try. I'll always try," I said. You've got to do better than try." She turned away from me and stared straight ahead of her, silent. This was really unlike her. In a minute or two, she began to talk. "I got pregnant when I was 19, she started. Unlike other times, she didn't laugh as she told this story, and she didn't really seem to be telling it to me. She spoke slowly, laboriously, and paused after each sentence with a look of slight shock on her face, as though surprised by what she just said. She seemed almost to be in a trance, and she didn't hesitate. She told as if compelled, as if once she'd begun, nothing could make her stop. "I wasn't married. It was my best friend's boyfriend. They'd broken up. He asked me to go for a drive. I'd never had a boyfriend. I was flattered. I'd never had sex before, and I didn't know what was happening. It was confusion. I was foolish, so foolish. Later, by the time I figured out I was pregnant, he and my best friend had gotten back together and gotten engaged. She was so happy I couldn't tell her. Now, I wasn't a girl. I was a full-grown woman with a job as a secretary, but I still lived at my parents' house, and I never knew anything about sex. That seems crazy, I know, but I didn't. When I told my parents, my father, oh, God, my father. He was so strict. He was the strictest father in the world. We weren't even allowed to wear skirts above the knee or a smudge of lipstick. I wasn't allowed to pluck my eyebrows, and then to get pregnant. To get pregnant, oh, my Lord, I thought he'd kill me. But instead, they sent me away. He and my mother both, they agreed to it. They said it was the only way. I had to go because I had nowhere else to live. No one to marry, not enough money to raise a baby. And once anyone figured out I was pregnant, I'd lose my job anyway. So what choice did I have? What choice did I have? No choice. I had no choice. Things were different back then, so different. I was trapped. Women like me, we ended up garbage. I didn't want to be garbage. I didn't want that, so I had to go. The home was in Charleston. I'd never been to Charleston before, but we weren't allowed to go out and explore. We just stayed in, me and the other girls there. 6 months later, I had my baby. Some of the people there said I shouldn't look at him because it would make it harder to give him up, because that's what I was going to do. That's what I had to do. I came back to my mother and father's house a few days later. When they picked me up, they didn't ask about it. I didn't get the addresses of any of the other girls there. It was like it never happened. I gave him up and had never seen him. But the next day, I knew I'd made a mistake. I woke up and I couldn't breathe. With every drop of my soul, I knew I'd made a mistake. I was like a caged animal. I couldn't stop moving. I'd made a terrible mistake. I had to get my baby back. I called up the home. I talked to the social worker. She was a Jewish woman from New York. Her name was Ruth. She was so skinny, you couldn't believe she could stand up straight. But she was the most intimidating woman I'd ever met. Ruth said I couldn't have the baby back. I told her I had to have him back. She told me it was better for the baby to go to a family. I said I had to get him back. She said he'd be better off without me, on account I had no money and no husband. I just kept telling her I had to get my baby back. Finally, she said that if I wanted my baby back, I had to pay for him. I had to buy him back. I had to pay back all the money they'd spent on me. I had to pay for 6 months of room and board, for the doctor visits, for the delivering the baby in the hospital, for the baby's doctor visits, for the formula they were giving him, for the nurses who'd taken care of him since he'd been born. She was sorry, but that was the rules. "If I can do that," I asked, if and I can do that, pay that money back, can I have him? Can I have my baby?" "Yes," she said, "but you'd be making a big mistake," she said in the calmest, angriest voice I ever heard. "A terrible mistake. It would be the worst thing for the baby and for you. You have no husband, no home of your own, not enough money to buy him shoes and clothes and food." I sold everything I had to raise the money. I sold my car, I sold the record player, all my records. I sold all my clothes except for one dress and one pair of shoes. I sold every gift anyone had ever given me. every bit of jewellery. I even sold my hair curlers. I used every penny of my savings. Finally, I had enough money. When I told my parents I was going to get my baby, I thought my father would have a stroke right there in the living room. I never seen someone so angry. I was so scared. I thought I might turn to dust from the fear, but I knew I had to do this. They kicked me out. I went to friends, but they couldn't help me. I even told my best friend and her husband, my son's father. I don't know if he knew he was the daddy. But he looked right at me and said, no, no, he would not help. I had nowhere to live. So finally, I went to my grandmother. She had a big farm out in the country. I told her what had happened. I was afraid she'd turn me out too, but instead she said, I will help you and your baby can live here with me. She drove me to Charleston in the car. When we got there, Ruth, the Jewish social worker from New York, met us in her office. She asked me if I really wanted to do this. I just pushed the envelope of money onto the table. She looked at me real hard. She was never one to smile, and she didn't smile now. But her face was not so stiff, I thought. Softer, maybe, I thought, I hoped. Ruth called a nurse to bring the baby in. He was a month old already. It was the first time they've ever seen him. When the nurse brought him in, my grandmother stood up and walked over to reach out for him. But then Ruth stood up and got in between my grandmother and the baby. No, she said, that's not how this is going to be. She took the baby in her arms. I thought she was going to take the baby back right in front of my eyes, take him away from me. I started to cry. But instead, she walked over to me where I was sitting, stuck in a chair like a statue. She put him in my arms. She is his mother, Ruth said to my grandmother. She gets to hold him. Ruth turned to me then. I've never met a woman who is more a mother than you, she said to me. You are his mother. Don't let anyone take him away from you. If you love him like this all his life, he'll be fine. She still didn't smile. She put her hands on my arms and squeezed harder than I would have thought someone so skinny could squeeze. I've made so many mistakes in my life. This is the one thing I know I did right. It's the best thing I ever did my whole life. I fought to get my baby back. I gave up everything to get my baby back. It's the greatest thing I ever did or ever will do. I got my baby back. Gloria stopped, out of breath from the exertion of telling me. She snapped out of her trance and I did too. She turned to look at me. Her face looked different. She pinned me with her eyes, drained but fierce. I want you to tell him, she said. I'll give you his phone number. You can call up my son and tell him. I want him to know. His father was also always so mean to him, and I want my boy to understand that it wasn't him. His father was mean because he resented him. My son wasn't his baby. I married him when my son was a year old, but he never came to love him right. I thought he would, told myself he would, but he never did. I want my son to know it wasn't because there's something deep wrong about him. I think he always thought that. I knew his father didn't love him right. I want my baby to know why before I die. Will you call him and tell him his father wasn't his real father? Pull out your phone. I'll give you his number. You can call him when you leave here. I stumbled, stammered. I'm not sure why I was so shocked by her request. Maybe because I usually only listen. I don't act. I was unprepared, so unsure of how to tell Gloria. I couldn't do what she was asking. She stared at me as I sat there with my mouth hanging open. Finally, she said, it's just a phone call. I pulled myself together and said, as gently as I could, I think that's something you need to tell him. Gloria had been calm the whole time she told me the story, but now tears welled in her eyes and her hands began to shake. I can't tell him. I can't. Please, you've got to tell him. I think that might be a bit of a shock, Gloria, if I called him out of the blue and told him that his father isn't really his father. He doesn't even know me. He'd be relieved. He'd be happy. There's no other way, she began to cry. You could tell him, I said as gently as I could. No, I can't. Why not? Because, and there she could barely speak. She shook so hard that the recliner shook underneath her. Because what, she sounded like she might choke. Because what if, she was almost hyperventilating. What if he doesn't think it was a good thing that I went back for him? The thought hung heavy in the air. I've learned over the years that these heavy, painful, anguish-filled moments, and believe me, they are anguish-filled for me too, these moments when I so badly want to say something to break the tension are exactly the moments I need to stay silent. They're the moments I need to hold still, hold that sacred space open, because when I can hold still and hold on in that place, no matter how hard it is for both of us, something can happen. Gloria shook and cried for a little while, but for far less time than you might think.
Now that she had given voice to her greatest fear, she could examine it. What if he doesn't think it's the best thing I ever did was a good thing at all? What if the social worker was right? What if he wishes I left him at the unwed mother's home? What if he wishes some other family adopted him? What if he had a different mother? What if he wishes I'd never gone back for him? I listened and waited. I knew I didn't have the answers, but I'd also been at this sort of juncture often enough to know that the patient does somewhere deep inside. Maybe not the answers to the questions they've just asked, but answers to deeper questions that lie under the fear. Gloria closed her eyes. For a moment, I thought she might be so worn out she'd fallen asleep, but then she continued. It's amazing you can love someone so much when you have never met him. I loved my son so much, and I didn't even know him. How's that possible? How's it possible to love someone so much that you're willing to give up your whole life, but you don't know him? I want him to know because I want him to know how much I love him, that I loved him before I even knew him, that I love him because of who he is, that I love him not because of who he is, but just because he is. That's what I want him to know. What if the thing you'd consider to be your greatest accomplishment is not seen that way by anyone else? What if the thing that you're proudest of is also the thing you're most ashamed of? What if your great love is also your deepest secret? People keep secrets in desperate and often ultimately futile attempt to protect themselves or the people they love. They think the secret will be a bulwark against rejection and public humiliation, so they carry it no matter what the weight. In many cases, people keep secrets and even lie to each other out of love, not malice. What they may not realise is that holding on so fiercely to what they seem as shameful secrets, they're actually strengthening the system of shame. Keeping a secret is like fertilising a weed. The family secrets that fertilise shame choke out love before it can even grow. The secrets themselves, instead of protecting anyone from shame, become a source of it. Instead, shame is the enemy of love. It can never serve it. I don't know what it was like for Gloria's cousin Betty to have the secret of her identity since she was a small child, to know that her grandmother saw her as a source of shame. I never got to meet Betty, but I can imagine, what I can imagine makes me want to cry. Did Betty's cruel burden protect Gloria from pain? Of course not. The only thing that the secret protected either woman from was each other's love and support. Gloria commented more than once the sadness of missing out on decades of Betty's life, yet even knowing this, Gloria kept the secret of her son's birth from him. She wanted to protect him from what she felt was her shame and by extension his shame. It simply kept her from sharing the enormity of her love. Now, even as she lay dying, desperate for him to know, she still was not sure she could break through the shame and explain the depth of her love. Fear of rejection and humiliation still held its grip after a lifetime in a stew of secrets. What if the person you love the most does not love you back? What happens if you pour your love into the world and are rejected? Do you pour your love out anyway? Is it worth a risk? Is love stronger than shame? These were Gloria's real questions. Every visit thereafter, Gloria asked me to call her son. She pleaded, she begged. She was desperate for her son to know and convinced she could not do it herself. At first, trying to talk about why she was too afraid to tell him herself just caused more anguish. So I sidestepped her request more as gracefully as I could. I asked her to tell me the story again and again to get it right when it was time to tell him. Within a few weeks, Gloria had a new suggestion. You could tell him and I could sit next to you. That could work, I said. She told me again what she wanted to say. A few weeks later, she said, I might could tell him and you could sit next to me. That could work, I said. Then she practiced what she'd say to him with me. The week after that, she said, I told my son when he was here on the weekend. How did it go? She smiled and began to cry. But then she began to laugh as she cried, as she always did, and she couldn't speak. Happy Mother's Day.